From WHYY in Philadelphia, this is Fresh Air. I'm Dave Davies, filling in for Terry Gross. On today's Fresh Air, the Book of Revelation, the final book of the New Testament, which describes the end of the world and the creation of a new heaven and earth. We talk with Jonathan Kirsch about his new book, A History of the End of the World, how the most controversial book in the Bible changed the course of Western civilization. Also, we talk with Ingrid Mattson, the new president of the Islamic Society of North America. She's the first woman, the first convert, and the first native North American elected to the position. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news. This is Fresh Air. I'm Dave Davies in for Terry Gross. The four horsemen of the apocalypse, the seventh seal, the great whore of Babylon, the mark of the beast, 666, and the battle of Armageddon are just some of the images from the book of Revelation that continue to resonate, not just for those who study the Bible, but in our popular culture. Revelation is the final book of the New Testament, and it describes the end of the world followed by the creation of a new heaven and earth. Jonathan Kirsch has written a new book called A History of the End of the World, How the Most Controversial Book in the Bible Changed the Course of Western Civilization. Kirsch has written several books about the Bible, including The Harlot by the Side of the Road, King David, Moses, a Life, and God Against the Gods. He's also a book columnist for the Los Angeles Times. Yesterday, Terry recorded this interview with Kirsch.
Jonathan Kirsch, welcome to Fresh Air. Would you describe the basic story as told in Revelation?
Well, first I want to say that the storyline has to be teased out because the book is written in a phantasmagorical frame of mind, kind of like a fever dream. It's not told from beginning to end, and that's one of the reasons it's such a crazy-making book. But when you puzzle it out and parse it out, it's the story of the end of the world as revealed to its author by Jesus himself. It tells how Jesus will return to earth as a conquering warrior, do battle with Satan and Satan's armies on earth at the Battle of Armageddon, establish a 1,000-year kingdom on earth. King Jesus will reign as an earthly king for 1,000 years. Then Satan, who has been bound in chains, will break loose. Jesus will fight a second battle, and this time he will destroy the world, judge all who ever lived, raise the dead, and judge the living as well. Those who are granted admission to a new earth and a new heaven will live forever in paradise, and those who fail to make the cut will suffer forever in a lake of fire and brimstone. The old world will be long gone.
Now, there are a lot of images in Revelation that have become a part of literature, history, popular culture. Let's just run through some of those. Let's start with 666.
Well, 666 is that spooky number. Even if you've never read the book of Revelation, you know about 666 because it's permeated our popular culture. And that's one of the arguments I make in my book as well. Revelation is imprinted on the Western imagination and has been for 20 centuries. It is soaks into our very consciousness. And so even readers who have never opened a Bible, and certainly readers who've never gotten to the book of Revelation, know that 666 is a diabolical number. It's not quite as spooky a number in Revelation as it has been made out to be. It is the number of the beast, but the beast in the eyes of the author of Revelation was probably the Roman emperor under whose reign the author lived and who symbolized to the author the political and cultural oppression of the Roman emperor. So probably 666 is an alphanumeric code for a Roman emperor, usually made out to be Nero, possibly Domitian, but not necessarily the devil.
Now, I want to ask you about the rapture. Let's start with a description of what the rapture is.
Well, the rapture, simply put, is the idea that good Christians, Christians worthy of salvation, will be miraculously lifted off of earth into heaven at precisely the moment when the earth goes into its death throes. According to Revelation, there will be a period of suffering and persecution called the tribulation. Depending on how you read that text, that might last 3.5 years. More recently, it's been taken to last 7 years. But however long it lasts, it's not going to be a happy time on earth. And according to the book of Revelation, everyone's going to have to suffer through it. And then at the end of the tribulation, Jesus will judge the world and save those whom he deems worthy to save. Christians in the 19th century, especially in North America, found this idea to be very off-putting. After all, if they were good Christians, why would they have to suffer through the tribulation? And so an Anglo-Irish minister named John Nelson Darby improvised upon another strand of biblical text, a stray line from Paul's letter to the Thessalonians, in which the image is presented that Christians will rise and meet Jesus in the air. And this was made out to be the phenomenon of the rapture. In other words, a free pass to escape the tribulation. It's not explicitly in the book of Revelation, but like so much else, it's come to be attached to the book of Revelation so that its most ardent readers today understand that the end time scenario of Revelation includes this very strange phenomenon called the rapture.
So is the concept of the rapture, which means that Christian believers will not have to suffer through the tribulation, but will rather rise up and go to heaven. Is this just a 19th century concept?
It's a 19th century innovation. It has some roots that you can trace back to earlier eras, but it was really articulated as an idea and a very popular and compelling idea only in the mid-19th century and became really popular primarily in the United States. And I want to say, if I may, that everything we've been talking about is based on how human beings, men and women like ourselves, have interpreted this strange, troubling text. And one example of how it has been reinterpreted in recent times is the notion of the rapture. But there are other examples as well, including this very strange idea of the Antichrist. That's another word that doesn't appear in Revelation. It's been read into Revelation, but becomes useful in the kind of culture wars that we see being fought in our own time and throughout history.
So you say the word Antichrist is not used in the book of Revelation, but there is a concept that's similar. I mean, there is a satanic figure in it.
There is a figure in the book of Revelation who has taken to be the agent of the devil on earth, or if not the devil himself. And that figure is called the beast in Revelation, not the Antichrist, but has come to be identified with the figure that is more popularly known as the Antichrist.
And how is the beast physically described?
Well, if you ask Jerry Falwell, he was recently quoted as saying that the Antichrist must be of necessity a Jewish male. Now, the reason he comes to that conclusion is based on this very detailed, almost obsessive reading of Revelation that is engaged in by many modern readers of the text. But that goes back a long way as well. There was a belief in the Middle Ages that the Antichrist would be the spawn of the devil and a Jewish harlot in a brothel in Babylon, what is now modern Iraq. But he is understood to be a human agent of the devil on earth who will come to power in the end times, do battle against Jesus, and lose.
And Falwell thinks that the Antichrist will be Jewish because of the Jewish harlot that spawns him, according to that line that you just referred to?
Well, if you put together words and phrases and passages from Revelation, you can cook up an argument for why the Antichrist might be Jewish, but it is very deeply linked with a strain of anti-Semitism, of Jewish fear and hatred of Jews that emerged in early Christianity and came to be attached to the idea of the Antichrist. And that's carried forward 20 centuries into our own time when Jerry Falwell insists that of necessity the Antichrist must be Jewish.
Would you choose a passage that you find most interesting from Revelation and a passage that you think, you know, epitomizes the writing in Revelation?
I'd be happy to do it. Let me point out the passage I'm going to read shows us a vision of Jesus that we find only in Revelation. Jesus is a kind and gentle figure in the Gospels and a very relatable, almost human figure. I mean, literally human in the Gospel narratives. In Revelation, he becomes the Lamb of God, slaughtered and yet standing upright. And when he comes back to earth, here is how it's described. And I saw heaven opened, and behold, a white horse, and he that sat upon him was called Faithful and True, and in righteousness he doth judge and make war. His eyes were as a flame of fire, and on his head were many crowns, and he had a name written that no man knew but he himself, and he was clothed with a vesture dipped in blood, and his name was called the Word of God, and out of his mouth goes a sharp sword. With it he should smite the nations, and he should rule them with a rod of iron. and he treadeth the winepress of the fierceness and wrath of Almighty God. And I saw an angel standing in the sun, and he cried with a loud voice, saying to all the fowls that fly in the midst of heaven, come and gather yourselves together for the supper of the great God, that ye may eat the flesh of kings.
Why don't you compare for us that image of Jesus with the image in the Gospels?
The image in the Gospels is Jesus as a human figure, a teacher, a man who travels from place to place in the company of other men and women and teaches human beings, mortals, how to live decently and kindly and to treat each other with love and generosity. Jesus in the Gospels was a remaker of Judaism, emphasizing the kindness and compassion of Judaism. Here we have a remaker of Judaism who emphasizes the punishing nature of the Old Testament God and turns Jesus into a warrior on a charging steed with a sword projecting from his mouth, bathing the world in blood. According to the text of Revelation, blood will flow up to the halters of the horses. We will literally be flooded with blood. And that angry, punishing, vengeance-seeking image of Jesus is quite at odds with the kind and gentle moral teacher that we see in the other passages of Scripture.
Who wrote Revelation? Do we know?
Intriguingly, as mysterious a book as it is, we can conjure up the author of Revelation with a good deal more detail than many of the other authors of the biblical texts. By Christian tradition, the author of Revelation was supposedly the Apostle John, the beloved disciple of Jesus, the author of the fourth gospel. Conventional scholarship dismisses that idea and has for many centuries. Its author was probably a Jewish man from Judea, the Jewish homeland, possibly someone who had witnessed the Jewish war, the war against the Jewish people by Rome, had witnessed the destruction of the temple, a war refugee who traveled to Asia Minor, and one of those Jews who embraced the idea that Jesus of Nazareth was the Messiah. The author almost undoubtedly thought of himself as a good Jew. In fact, he says he is an authentic Jew in the text itself.
If the author of Revelation was Jewish, why are there anti-Semitic phrases within the book?
It goes very much to his idea of his own Jewishness. There's really only one unambiguously anti-Semitic line in which he refers to his fellow Jews as members of the synagogue of Satan. And now that's a very hateful phrase, and Jewish readers have been deeply put off by it over the centuries. But what the author means to say is, I, the author of Revelation, am a good Jew, and those of you who refuse to embrace the idea that Jesus was the Jewish Messiah are bad Jews. So when he refers to other Jews as being members of the synagogue of Satan, he's simply saying you are insufficiently Jewish to merit membership in the authentic synagogue.
We're listening to Terry's interview with Jonathan Kirsch, author of A History of the End of the World. It's about the book of Revelation. We'll hear more after a break. This is Fresh Air. Let's get back to Terry's interview with Jonathan Kirsch, author of A History of the End of the World, about the book of Revelation.
Interpretations of Revelation have changed through the centuries. What do you find one of the most interesting interpretations of Revelation today, and what do you think it says about our time?
Well, the dominant interpretation of Revelation in our time is the same idea with a different articulation that has been expressed in every generation, which is that the original author was wrong to believe these things would happen in his generation. They are all going to happen in our generation. Again, that's nothing new. Every generation has included readers of Revelation who ardently believe that. But we are in an era of mass media, so you can turn on your television or your radio or pick up, go on the internet, and you'll find countless people who will, in detail, in I might say painful detail, explain to you why all of those spooky signs of the end that are described in Revelation are in fact things that are happening in the headlines. This was recently argued during the fighting on the northern border of Israel between Israel and Hezbollah. This was seen yet again as an augury of the end. But I think there's a more the fighting on the between Israel and Hezbollah was seen as the early signs of that final battle between Satan and God that is predicted in the book of Revelation. The idea that any particular war or natural phenomenon or political crisis might be a sign of the end times is a very common way to read the book of Revelation, never more popular than it is today. There are other ways to read the book of Revelation, however. There are so-called advocates of liberation theology who believe that Revelation can be looked on as a progressive text, a text that calls upon people to fight against injustice and oppression, such that Daniel Berrigan, an activist priest, most active during the 60s, thought of Revelation as a handbook of political protest against American capitalism and the military-industrial complex. And there are still readers who will say that Revelation inspires a book or a text like Martin Luther King's Letter from a Birmingham Jail, which was a great progressive manifesto. It's not necessarily a text that's read and used only by the Christian right.
Could you compare how Catholics and Protestants who are not fundamentalists interpret Revelation compared to the more literal reading of it?
From the very beginning of Christian history, there has been an argument over how to read Revelation. Some people are inclined to read it literally, but the mainstream of Christianity in antiquity and over the last 2,000 years and in today's world read the book of Revelation metaphorically. St. Augustine articulated this idea in the 5th century. It became church dogma. We are meant to understand Revelation as explaining the world to us in allegorical terms, or what Augustine called spiritual terms. The Catholic Church, the mainstream Protestant churches, and the vast majority of Christians who read and study Revelation approach it as allegory and not literal truth.
In reading it over and over again, which I imagine you did in preparation for your book, A History of the End of the World, what are some of the things you saw in Revelation that you had never seen there before, or new interpretations that you had as a result of multiple readings?
The single most compelling discovery that I made in my own understanding of Revelation is that the author hated above all the idea that a Christian, or for that matter, Jewish person, could lead the good life in a culture like the culture of Roman paganism. The author of Revelation hated pleasure. He hated opulence. He hated the good things of life. He hated sex. He hated good food. He believed that the world was going to end imminently, and everybody should get ready for the end by purifying themselves. The mark of the beast, which we touched on very briefly earlier in our conversation, that spooky number 666, almost certainly refers to nothing more exotic or diabolical than a Roman coin, which to him symbolized the medium of exchange by which you bought the good things of life, which he felt a righteous person should forego. The mark of the beast is the symbol of the emperor on a Roman coin, just as we have Thomas Jefferson or George Washington on our coinage.
You know what I'm wondering after talking to you about this? Do you think that Revelation has has led a lot of people to expect that there is not only an imminent end to the world, but it's inevitable that it's going to be like bloody and horrible with pestilence and, you know, just things indescribably horrible.
One of the great uses of Revelation, then and now, is to help us understand the terrible things that happen in the real world. Throughout history and in our own times as well, we are aware that there's war, famine, pestilence, natural disaster. Terrible things happen in the world. We need only open our morning newspaper or turn on NPR, and we'll hear the headlines. What does all this chaos and terror mean? Revelation and the whole apocalyptic idea allow us to see it as the working out of God's will, God's master plan for the end of the world. And that idea has imprinted itself on the Western imagination. We are taught by our religious traditions, and this is true in Judaism, Christianity, and Islam, that the world will end in fire and brimstone, with a bang and not a whimper. And that's one of the ways Revelation has changed the course of history. It has inclined us to see in the events of day-to-day life, and especially the most horrible events, the hand of God.
Well, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Terry, it's been a real pleasure for me, and I thank you for the opportunity.
Jonathan Kerr speaking with Terry Gross. His new book about the Book of Revelation is called A History of the End of the World. I'm Dave Davies, and this is Fresh Air.
Support for NPR comes from Barnes & Noble, publishers of the Barnes & Noble Classics edition of Oscar Wilde's The Picture of Dorian Gray, available in stores and online at bn.com. From the American Cancer Society Cancer Action Network, working to make cancer a national priority at Celebration on the Hill, details at acscan.org. And from audible.com, where you can download and listen to Fresh Air in addition to audiobooks, magazines, and newspapers. audible.com/freshair. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, the new president of the Islamic Society of North America. Ingrid Mattson is the first woman, the first convert, and the first native North American elected to the position. This is Fresh Air. I'm Dave Davies in for Terry Gross. Last month, Ingrid Mattson became the first woman to be elected president of the Islamic Society of North America. She had served as vice president since 2001. Mattson was raised Roman Catholic in Canada and went to a Catholic high school, but converted to Islam in 1987 when she was in college. Now she's a professor of Islamic studies at Hartford Seminary in Connecticut. The Islamic Society of North America was established in 1963 and is now the largest group representing Muslims in North America. It supports Muslim communities and tries to build bridges to other religions. Terry spoke with Ingrid Mattson yesterday.
Ingrid Mattson, welcome to Fresh Air. Now, you are the first woman, the first Native North American, and the first convert to be elected president of the Islamic Society of North America. Which of those firsts have you been getting the most comments about?
Certainly being the first woman has generated the most interest among people. I had expected that. I was, frankly, a little bit surprised at the amount of interest in the fact that I'm a Native born North America, and in particular that I'm a white North American, was something that I didn't expect to generate quite so much interest.
And what has been the nature of the reaction to that, to you being Native North American and white?
To some extent, I found it a little bit troubling because there's some underlying almost racist implications to me in that Muslims really should not be white people. They should be people of color. Of course, there's nothing wrong with being a person of color, and the reality is that in North America, most Muslims are people of color. But it's almost a kind of unease that that someone who is maybe from the privileged race would decide to join the Muslim community.
Now, you grew up Catholic and went to Catholic school. You later converted to Islam. When you were Catholic, were you deeply involved in Catholicism? And did you ever even think of becoming a nun?
I think the only time it ever occurred to me to become a nun was, or the only reason I would have thought of becoming a nun was that the convent was just so peaceful. And I grew up in a family of seven kids. With four brothers and two sisters. So my house was always in motion, it was constant chaos. And I used to go to the convent and think, this is so nice and peaceful. But on the other hand, I also used to go to the library, which was at the other end of the street, and think the same thing. So perhaps that's why both scholarship and a religious life appealed to me as I got older.
How were you introduced to Islam?
Well, I was, I left the church when I was perhaps 15 years old. I lost my faith around that time and stopped attending church. I spent perhaps 6 years as an agnostic or an atheist. I really don't even know now what I believed at that time. Went on, studied philosophy, and pretty much left religion behind, not thought of it as an option for my life. But then I went to Paris for a summer where I was studying film with my fine arts program and made very good friends with some West African students who happened to be Muslim. And they weren't particularly observant Muslims, but there was something in them that was so lovely, so attractive, their generosity and humility and kindness, that I wanted to know more about them and their life and their culture, and found out that Islam was part of it and started reading more about it, and found myself, to my surprise, drawn in to this faith.
And when did you convert?
I was in my last year of university, a senior in college, when I became a Muslim.
What was your parents' reaction?
Well, My father died when I was young, so I was living with my mother at the time, and I was very concerned about her reaction because, like all teenagers, I hadn't always given my mother the easiest time, and she'd had a rough time since my father had died, raising seven kids on her own. So I didn't want to give her something that would be upsetting, and I knew this would be difficult for her to understand. And it was. We didn't know any Muslims, so it was more a question of a vague unease about what this was all about. So it took some time, and more than anything, I think it just took her seeing what this meant in my life to make her feel comfortable.
One of the things you did after you converted to Islam was go to Pakistan, where you worked in a refugee camp for Afghan women. What year was this?
This was in 1987 when I went to Pakistan.
Oh, okay. So it was a long time ago. This was, the Soviets were still in Afghanistan then?
That's right. There was still active fighting in Afghanistan, and mm-hmm. I went to Pakistan, lived in Peshawar, and was working in refugee camps outside of the city.
And what kind of interactions did you have with the Taliban?
Well, they weren't really known as Taliban, but at that time, it was only some years later that they became more constituted as a kind of force. At that time, there were all sorts of groups operating and working among the Afghans, political parties as well as religious organizations. And the Taliban type person, I knew. I mean, I ran into some of those people in the refugee camp. There were some areas in the camp that I worked in. It was a camp of 100,000 people where the leaders really were not interested in having women's or girls' education. But in fact, what was interesting was that that was a very small segment of the population of the camp. The vast majority of Afghans, men and women, wanted us in there, wanted, you know, us to offer programs, health and education, reading and writing for girls as well as for boys. But it was only in some small areas where there were men who could keep us out. And what really struck me when the Taliban took over was that I knew that the only way they could do that was through the force of those tanks and the arms that they had, because the Afghan people generally were not convinced of their ideas or supportive of the kind of lifestyle that they were advocating, despite the fact that Afghans, by and large, are very religious people, and they consider themselves good Muslims, but not at all in the way that the Taliban interpret Islam.
Now, I understand you have a sister who converted to Judaism.
Yes, that's right.
And I think that's because she was marrying somebody who was Jewish.
That's right.
So it seems not typical to have a family in which two of the children converted to different religions.
Well, I guess it isn't. Perhaps it's becoming more typical in as society continues to globalize and we mm-hmm. interact with more and more people. But in a family of seven kids, yes, two of us chose another path, and I learned a lot from my sister. You know, I'm glad that I had her to talk to and as an example. Although we made our choice for very different reasons, but I've watched her over the years balance her her lifestyle and beliefs with still being a part of our family. So that was a good example for me. And also, my sister is a number of years older than I am, so what was good about that is that I had a long experience with the Jewish community before I was Muslim. I've gone to Jewish weddings, and my nephew's bris and bar mitzvah, my niece's bat mitzvah, so I'm very comfortable in Jewish religious settings and with Jewish people. I think that helps me as a Muslim leader bring some balance to our community or perspective to our community that often finds itself in some kind of tension with the Jewish community.
Yeah, so how do you deal with this like anti-Semitic strain within parts of the Islamic community?
Well, it needs to be dealt with first theologically. It's not permissible for a Muslim to hate a person because they're Jewish or to tell ridiculous lies about Jews or to make absurd claims like the Holocaust is not real or was exaggerated. I mean, it's a question of knocking those things down very quickly, but then also on the other side, working with the Jewish community to dispel their misconceptions, because I believe there are as many misconceptions on the part of the Jewish community about Muslims as there are on the other side. And there is anti-Muslim rhetoric as well. Certainly there are differences and there are some tensions, but there doesn't have to be hostility and conflict.
We're listening to Terry's interview with Ingrid Mattson, the new president of the Islamic Society of North America. We'll hear more after a break. This is Fresh Air. Let's get back to Terry's interview with Ingrid Mattson. Last month, she became the first woman elected as president of the Islamic Society of North America.
This week, an organization of 56 Islamic nations urged the Pope to apologize for his comments about Islam. The Pope had quoted a 14th century Byzantine Christian emperor who said, "Show me just what Muhammad brought that was new, and there you will find things only evil and inhuman, such as his command to spread by the sword the faith he preached." What's your understanding of what the Pope was intending to communicate when he quoted that?
Well, I read the I read a translation of the whole speech from beginning to end, and his main point was that he was making was that Christianity has come to terms with reason, and because Christianity has come to terms with reason and rationality is the basis of European civilization, that Christianity can form the cultural base for European civilization, but Islam, on the other hand, is a religion that is irrational, that does not believe in a rational God or a rational order, divine order, and therefore the implication being, and an implication that he's spelled out in other speeches, that Islam will always remain to some extent foreign to the European continent and civilization. And that, to me, is the most troubling aspect of his speech.
Now, you grew up Roman Catholic. You went to a Catholic high school and then in college converted to Islam. Now, you teach, among other things, Muslim-Christian relations. So what are some of the things that you feel like Muslims and Christians don't get about each other but need to comprehend?
I think that Christians, first of all, need to have more facts about the reality of the interaction between Christians and Muslims over the centuries, and Christians, Muslims, and maybe even Jews over the centuries. People often say things like, well, people in the Middle East have been fighting for thousands of years, or they've always been in conflict. But historically, that's just not accurate. There are all sorts of great historical studies that show wonderful examples of cooperation, of synthesis, of intermarriage, of communal harmony, of trade, mutual support. At the same time, there are cases of conflict, and I think Christians need to be more aware of the role of Christianity really in that, and the fact that for many centuries, the Catholic Church especially, was a very oppressive force against not only Muslims, but Jews as well. And with respect to Muslims, Muslims need to understand why Christians embraced a secular civilization, that was a rational decision in the wake of so many centuries of religious conflict in which religious identity in Europe was conflated with citizenship. And that's why European countries moved to a secular society. It wasn't because they were trying to get rid of religion or because they were being irreligious, but because they wanted to not allow religion to be used for the purpose of oppression or political manipulation anymore. So Muslims really need to come to understand that so they can understand their place and role in these countries.
This week, a German opera house canceled performances of a Mozart opera because of a scene that was added to the opera. And in this scene, the king of Crete carries the heads of Muhammad, Jesus, and Buddha. And those heads are placed on a stool. Now, police warned that because Muslims would find this scene inflammatory, that there was an incalculable risk to the performers and the audience, and I think they were already getting death threats. Now, the opera company is being criticized in Germany for not standing up for artistic freedom. What do you make of this latest conflict between, a secular art performance and Muslims who are offended by it?
Mm. Well, it doesn't bother me if Muslims are offended by it. I would be offended by it as well, not only by the way Muhammad would be portrayed, but other prophets as well, just as I've been offended by some art that has, you know, used Christian icons in a disrespectful way. I understand artists have a right to express themselves and to try to bring people into their world and understand what they're trying to do. At the same time, religious people and others have a right to be offended, to voice their offense. The line, of course, is drawn at threats of violence. At that point, then those people need to be found by the police and questioned and charged if they actually made a threat of violence. I do think that sometimes, you know, I don't want to diminish the risk. Obviously, the police have assessed the risk. But at the same time, you know, sometimes I just wonder if these things aren't a little bit overblown in the media. And the reason I say that is in a country like Germany, where there are racist attacks on Muslims all the time. I mean, not just threats, but real beatings. Very violent attacks, and those aren't things that end up getting global attention. So I think it's an important issue. It's more of a local issue. I really don't think it's something that necessarily needs to attract kind of international attention when we look at all of the other things that are going on.
I guess here's one of the things I'm wondering. A lot of people feel that extremists are hijacking the Islamic religion. Extremists are interpreting the religion as justifying suicide bombing and attacks on perceived enemies. And I guess I wonder if you think that people such as you who don't interpret Islam that way are being effective in countering a more extremist point of view, or if you even see that as your job.
Well, I can only, and people like me can only use the means that are in our control. I don't have an army. I don't have an intelligence service at my command. I have my voice and my words. And so I use those in speech and writing. But the problem here is that there seems to be a feeling of group guilt or collective guilt. You know, the Muslim community is a worldwide community of over a billion people. There's no hierarchy, even within any country. There's no one leadership that can control all of the people, that can give orders or commands to all of the people or guide them. There's no ordination in Islam. So religious leadership is diffuse. And there's not someone who can stand up and kind of rally Muslims or direct them to do one action or another. And so you'll find people acting out of all sorts of interests and all sorts of motivations, whether it's emotional, political, whatever kind of dynamics they have. And each Muslim individual and group can only, you know, do what is within their power. But one thing we have to look at is the reality is that the primary victims of Muslims who commit acts of terrorism are other Muslims. So if you look at the Taliban, for example, I mean, who have been their victims? They've been other Muslims. And who are the people primarily who are in the front line stopping them? They're other Muslims who are Afghani Muslims in the police force, in the military, in the government. So this is something very important for us to recognize, that here in America, we often see this as a story of Muslims against the West or Muslims against America, Muslim extremists. But in fact, Muslims have suffered more from these kinds of extremism and are doing more to try to stop them very bravely. If you look in places like Iraq and Afghanistan, where men and women are going out every day to try to teach and work in hospitals and are often losing their lives for serving their people.
We're listening to Terry's interview with Ingrid Mattson, the new president of the Islamic Society of North America. Terry spoke to Mattson yesterday. German government officials and Muslim leaders in Germany have begun a 2-year dialogue on Muslim relations. At their first meeting Wednesday, the group recommended that the Berlin Opera reinstate the Mozart opera. At the time of this broadcast, a final decision had not yet been made. We'll hear more from Ingrid Mattson after a break. This is Fresh Air. Let's get back to Terry's interview with Ingrid Mattson. Last month, she became the first woman elected as president of the Islamic Society of North America.
We recently had on Pastor John Hagee, who's the head of a megachurch in Texas, and the founder of a Christian Zionist group. And he said in our recent interview that those who live by the Quran have a scriptural mandate to kill Christians and Jews. And I'd like to hear your reaction to that.
Well, that's incorrect. If that were true, there would not be any Jews or Christians left in Muslim lands. And in fact, the oldest Christian communities and the oldest Jewish communities are found in the world, lived under Muslim sovereignty for over 1,000 years. The Quran does not say that. And what's interesting to me is, if people like this want to be scriptural literalists in their own tradition and take verses out of context and, apply their own interpretation to them, that's fine. But they can leave my scripture alone. We have enough problems dealing with our own scriptural literalists. I don't need a Christian fundamentalist, Islamic literalist, if I may say.
So do you feel like one of the big splits now within the Christian community is whether the Bible should be read as literal truth or as more parable, metaphor? Do you think there's the same kind of split now in Islam about whether the Quran should be read literally?
I think the biggest problem is that our traditional schools, our seminaries, our traditions of interpretation were dismantled to a large extent under colonialism. And what happened is a very literalistic, decontextualized approach to scripture emerged in the 19th century. And we're still trying to come out of it. Classical Islamic exegesis, in fact, gives a lot of room for context, for harmonizing different verses, for bringing perspective from outside the text. And so much of that has disappeared. And what we're trying to do is to bring that back in, that approach to the text back in, and perhaps to bring in some other kinds of context or meaning that weren't always emphasized in traditional interpretation.
Do you ever feel that, you converted to Islam, for deeply personal and spiritual reasons, and now as the leader of an Islamic group, you're kind of at the center of a storm in a way, because relations have become so stormy, and I think that there must be a rift inside Islam now between more moderate and extreme interpretations of the Quran.
Yeah, I find my life surprising. It's not exactly what I expected it to be. I did become a Muslim, as you say, for deeply personal and spiritual reasons. But what I believe as a Muslim is that if your faith is sincere, that you are willing to put yourself in God's hands, and whatever He feels is your purpose, you have to take that up. As I say, I am the kind of person who would normally be happier in the library with a book, and I find myself in a very public position now. But this is my responsibility. It's one that it's also very much a privilege because I do get to see not only the bad things, but I get to see everyday kindness, people reaching out, trying to overcome their fears and their anxieties and their prejudices to be better themselves. So life is surprising, and I just consider myself to be in this time doing what I was destined to do.
Well, Ingrid Mattson, I want to thank you very much for talking with us. Thank you.
Thanks for the opportunity, Terry. It's been great speaking with you.
Ingrid Mattson is president of the Islamic Society of North America. Her interview with Terry was recorded yesterday. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our senior producer is Roberta Shorrock. Our engineer is Julian Hertzfeld. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Anne-Marie Baldonado, Ian Chillog, Patty Leswing, Sam Brigger, and Jonathan Menhivar. Sue Spolin directed the show. For Terry Gross, I'm Dave Davies.
Support for NPR comes from Endless Pools, swimming machines designed for exercise, fitness, and fun. DVD at 888-882-SWIM or endlesspool.com. From the Cato Charitable Foundation, advancing environmental values and saluting all those who work to sustain our world. And from the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, working to ensure that more students graduate from high school ready for college, work, and citizenship. GatesFoundation.org. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Break down. The barriers. Break down misunderstanding. Break down.
On the next Fresh Air, jazz pianist and composer Jason Moran. He's been described in Downbeat as one of the most important figures of his generation. His new album is Artist in Residence. Join us for the next Fresh Air. Break down.